Hey, it's Dr. Marissa Lee Naismith here, and I'm so honored to be sharing today's interview round episode with you. Listen, and you will be inspired by amazing healthcare practitioners, voice teachers, and music industry professionals who will share their stories, knowledge, and experiences within their specialized fields to help you live your best life every day. As singers, our whole body is our instrument, and our instrument echoes how we feel physically, mentally, and emotionally. So don't wait any longer. Take charge and optimize your instrument now. Remember that to sing is more than just learning about how to use the voice. It's about a voice and beyond. So without further ado, let's go to today's episode. Dan Mitten is a classical bass singer, voice teacher, and voice researcher. And for many of us, we know Dan as founder and one of the moderators for the Facebook group, The New Forum for Professional Voice Teachers, where he inspires conversations, arouses our curiosity, and creates a safe space for voice professionals to express themselves, share their thoughts and their knowledge. In this episode, we really get to know and learn more about Dan, his professional and academic background, as well as his achievements and how these have informed his teaching approaches. Dan is also a keen consumer of voice pedagogy literature and is passionate about connecting low male voice singers with the information they need to excel. He shares his thoughts on historical traditions in voice education and how these traditions, alongside the current voice science, inform the way we think about how the voice works today. Dan discusses the reasons for actively continuing his education, the role of the singing teacher, his teaching philosophy, how students learn more effectively, his legacy, and there is so much more. You are going to love getting to know Dan Mitten. So, without further ado, let's go to today's episode. Well, welcome to the show, Dan Mitten. It is such a pleasure to have you here. How is life for you in Toronto?
The seasons are changing in Toronto, and the autumn is my favorite time of year. So it is great here at the moment. It's cooled off and everything is ready to change color, and it couldn't be better.
Oh, that's fantastic. And we actually met a couple of weeks ago. Before then, we hadn't met at all. I reached out to you. I had been following you on the social media forum that you're in. We're going to talk about that a little bit more later. But we hadn't met, and our meeting was only supposed to be for like half an hour to set up our interview today. And we ended up talking for 2 hours. It was quite an incredible chat that we had, and I'm so excited about talking to you today. Now, prior to that, you may not remember, but I was actually put in the naughty corner for...
Tell me about that.
Okay. Now, the New Forum for Professional Voice Teachers is one that you are one of the moderators for, and I posted something in an untimely way, and it was taken down. So I was put in the naughty corner, and that was because of the difference in time zones, that I was confused, and I did my little brag about the podcast, but I missed the deadline. But you were so gracious in reaching out to me privately and explaining to me why my post had been taken down. And I really appreciated that. And then I think I started to follow you personally because I thought, this man's actually a good guy. So you probably don't remember any of that.
I don't. First of all, because we don't have a naughty corner.
Oh, you don't?
There's no.
You
no,
need to have one.
No, we really don't. But we do. The new Forum for Professional Voice Teachers is sort of an arena for conversations and whatnot. But the reality is we're all teachers and we all have something to sell. And so way back in the early planning stages of NFPBT, we looked at ways to limit people's exposure and to respect the majority of the people while also acknowledging that people have livelihoods and that they may have goods and services that they, you know, want to make available. So the only thing that you would have tripped is a time zone problem. Mm-hmm. Because yes, we allow, because we allow what we call self-promotion, but yes. Promotion of any commercial good or service. We allow that on Saturdays from 12:01 midnight to 11:59, you know, yes. Just before Sunday morning, Eastern Standard Time, because we're rooted in North America. You just would have missed that, but we didn't, these things happen enough that we don't attach a value judgment to that. We didn't think you were naughty at all. It's just something that happens. So to reach out is quite normal for the mods.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I'm just having a little bit of fun with it because my Australian humour, I have to put a spin on it. So I had to call it the naughty corner. I was put in the naughty corner, but I didn't feel naughty at all once you approached me and explained to me what had happened. Now, everyone, well, I would say most of the voice community is well aware of who you are because you put yourself out there in that forum almost on a daily basis. You share so much of your wealth and your knowledge and you ask really great questions. You share your books. But today, with this podcast episode, we would like to know, who is Dan Mitten? Who are you really? We want to get to know you personally because I'm sure you have some great stories to share. So why don't we just start with Dan and when you were a child and when did you start singing?
Oh, well, I think like a lot of folks with attachments to communities of faith, I started in church. So the church that I grew up in was, a specific stripe. I started singing, amazingly, you may be surprised at this, but CCM, because the aesthetic in that church was very karaoke to Jesus. So you would put on an accompaniment track with all the instrumentals of whatever favorite Christian artist you were into at the time. And you would go ahead and, you know, sing your ministry for your 3.5 minutes and, and that would be it. So I started like that.
Wow. Yeah. That's really interesting. So what point of time did you start having formal training and was that training or classical training?
Yeah. So in the church that I belonged to, there was a Christian Academy of Music and the Arts, and you could pay your money to join a group voice class. And that group voice class was basically just the music minister playing songs that you would sing to. And then you'd get group critique from your fellows in the class. Mm-hmm. And we had a mix of, men and women, and we had a mix of ages. I think I might've been the youngest at maybe 15 or 16, but we also had people in our class in their 50s and 60s, and they would be choristers from the congregation or folks who basically wanted to improve. And that was my first experience with sort of instruction. Yes. But when I was 18, just about, so here, high school in Canada, where I grew up, 18 is when you graduate. My friends were preparing for university and my family, we were not of a class of people that would value setting aside money for an education. So I was not going to be able to go to university. And then I learned that there was a small Christian liberal arts university in my hometown. And they had a music program. So I'd been singing in church and really enjoying that. I fancied myself an okay singer. And so I went and auditioned for them, and I was allowed into that program. And so I lived at home and worked part-time through school and started basically a Bachelor of Church Music. And I was there for 2 years.
Yes.
And then I transferred to the University of Ottawa and was there for 3 years. And then I transferred to the University of Toronto for the remaining 2 years of what turned out to be a 7-year bachelor's degree.
That's a lot.
It was a lot, but you know, I transferred twice. What do you expect, right? No school will take any other school's credits. So
right. Okay. Yeah. So two questions come to mind. Firstly, you said that you started your training in the church in that group setting. Now, you would have been going through voice change at that time.
Yeah, I think that my voice change was accomplished earlier. I think my voice change was finished around 15. Right. And so by the time I was doing group voice lessons, it would have been like a year after that, let's say. So I'm not so sure. But I will say that there's very little room for bass voice. So my voice type is bass, which is the lowest.
Yes. Yes.
And there's very little room for basses in pop music. And that holds true of contemporary Christian music as well. So you wind up doing things like, you know, jacking your larynx up in order to create a higher timbre. And you do these things instinctively. You're not aware that they're doing them. And even, you know, back in, so this would have been the late 80s. So nobody would have even known to tell you that was a tool in your handbag.
A lot of that back then probably for you would have been just you mimicking sound.
Mimicking trial and error and trying to mimic a tenor instrument with my bass instrument and not understanding why I was never going to be able to produce the sounds that I was hearing in these recordings.
Yes. Yeah. So did you find when you went through that voice change, even though you probably weren't aware of, you may not have been doing a lot of singing then, but did your voice just plummet or did you just keep trying to sing? Like, how do you go from this high voice, this beautiful high voice, to like all of a sudden to becoming a bass by the age of 15? Like, how was that experience for you?
I love that you're asking me to, in the context of our conversation, go back 30 years.
Yes.
And
you don't remember 30 years ago.
I do remember that at the time that I went through puberty, one of the big hits on the radio was Lean On Me. You know that, that song.
Yes.
And so there's a sort of a bassy kind of introduction in the melody.
Yes.
And it all of a sudden got very, very easy to plumb the color of that particular line. So for me, that was the indicator, you know, being able to produce a convincing bass for that one pop song.
Mm-hmm.
Was like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe my outcome will be low male voice. But honestly, I mean, as I, you know, it's so, my dissertation focuses on my twin areas of interest and expertise, which are low male voice development and Russian lyric diction.
Yes.
And as I've learned more about low male voices and how they operate, I'm convinced that there's a genetic component.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since my dad sang bass or still sings bass in the choir. And my mom was a lady. My mom was a lady tenor, you know, very low voiced woman.
Wow.
And so if I inherited any of the morphology of their folds and the way their bodies are configured, then it only makes sense that I would be a low male voice.
Yes. So then it came as no surprise to you. And then you would have gone to university. And is that where you studied classical voice training?
Right. So the little Christian liberal arts university in my hometown where I did my first 2 years was all classical. And that was also the case at Ottawa University and finally the University of Toronto. I achieved my bachelor's degree, I think I got it in 1997. And if I'm not mistaken, there were no, real formal institutional academically based CCM training at that time.
Yes.
I imagine Jeannie Lovaci probably would know that better than me. But
yes,
I did not know, like, for instance, we had a jazz program. And so I went to school mm-hmm. with jazz singers at mm-hmm. the University of Toronto. But we never saw them and we didn't coexist. I just, like, my friend Heather was a jazz singer and I would see her at parties. That's it. We would never, our classwork never intersected and I never saw her academically.
Yes. So there was quite a segregation back then in terms of.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you must have, you know, 30 years ago, you must admit that you recall the segregated idea between styles.
Well, my journey has been rather unique because I didn't go into academia till after having quite a long career as a CCM performer. I didn't. Yes. So I did everything the wrong way around. I was a performer I should say I did it all uniquely. Let's use the word uniquely. I had my career first and a very successful career. I then transitioned into teaching, which I fell into, and then went into a university setting. So I didn't go to university till 2008.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes, yes. And I went in and did postgraduate studies. But even then, there was a high art, low art mentality. And that still continues on. But this is about you.
Well, I think this is a really, really important thing. Mm. So I will acknowledge that when I came up through the system, all of that cultural garbage was true in as much as I saw it. And there were, you know, terrible silos, teachers not communicating with each other. And that whole toxic presence, that was a thing. Yes. And also, you know, value judgments against anything other than classical music and the intimation that classical was better somehow or healthier or more, you know, whatever. That was real, but that's from another time now. And yes. So I earned my undergraduate in 97 and then I earned an artist diploma. I finished that in 2002 at the Royal Conservatory. And then I was gone for a decade, living life and having a career not related to music. But when I returned to grad school to begin my master's degree in 2012, the world had changed. Mm-hmm. And now there was a new, it was okay to voice a respect and an admiration for CCM singers.
Yes.
And there was a push toward cross training in the studio. And now we have that marvelous book by Norman Spivey and Mary Saunders Barton, right? Mm-hmm. So it's been a really pleasant reordering of values for people who are really interested in voice, evidence-based voice training. You're always going to have insecure folks who need to position themselves as better than their neighbor. And that is human nature. But it does not reflect the reality. For instance, to come back to the forum, in our forum, we want the new forum for professional voice teachers to be style agnostic. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that one style is any better than that. You can excel in any number of styles, but the way our physical voice works, the vocal acoustics, the way that voices operate in space, there is a way to understand the optimal working of the voice that is not style dependent. And I think that this is a really important nexus for us to find common ground. And I love attending, you know, I remember a couple of years ago, I went to the acoustic voice pedagogy workshop at the New England Conservatory.
Yes.
And in that room, there were significantly high profile Broadway coaches right next to rubbing shoulders with classical teachers. And style was not, I don't know if I'm fooling myself, but style was not a thing. We all were appreciating the information, all trying to struggle with what it means to have a formant harmonic relationship and all that. And everyone is hungry for this stripe of acoustic evidence-based ways of understanding the voice. So how are you going to see that voices work the way they do, that sound propagates itself through air the way it does, and then try and tell me that one way of using your folds is invalid?
Yes.
And that you should only use them in a certain way.
Yes.
I have to tell you, even within classical music, there is space for non-classical effect. You know, in how many operas have you seen where they do a character move, or there's some justification for a cough or a snarl or a breathy tone in a recitative? You know, these are all more common than our steely teachers would have been happy to admit.
Yes. I love how you put all of that. I love the way that you just answered that question. And yes, I think we definitely, we have come a very long way, even in the last, even 3 or 4 years. There's been a lot of, I think we have come a long way. And you're right, there are still some people, and I think they're afraid of what they don't know.
I think of some folks processing voice instruction as religious dogma.
Yes. And
when I hear it that way, because I'm not a person of faith now, that is not part of my life anymore. But I do understand, you know, having been very highly churched for 20 years, I understand the trappings of and the tribalism of adherence to a code, to a faith. And so I do see that with some schools of singing.
Oh, absolutely. And
one of the things that I think debunks that very quickly is a knowledge of historical voice pedagogy and the understanding that practitioner X, Y, or Z did not invent that, and that this actually comes to us through a long lineage from, you know, so-and-so and such-and-such. And so when we can start to retrace where a particular exercise comes from, or why semi-occluded vocal tract exercises leave us feeling so good after we do them because of the work of such and such voice scientist. These things help us to understand that they didn't emerge fully formed as the gift to humanity of one person and their cash bottleneck, where for a small fee, they'll share the mystery with you. That's no longer part of working vocal instruction in the 21st century. Instead, there's there's a pluralism, and there's a sharing among colleagues that I want our forum, for instance, to be a big part of. I want there to be a free exchange of knowledge, and that is frowned upon by folks who guard their knowledge and put a price tag next to it. And I am aware that folks who excel at the business of singing frown at me giving away my intellectual property, but it's not mine.
Yes.
I just am like showing people which book to look at and, you know, offering somebody, you know, I found this free resource. It could help you. Or, oh, you're having problems with the soprano in her upper passaggio? Well, I happen to know that this person is an expert in that. Why don't you talk to them? They're part of our group.
Yes.
And making these connections is, I it's a drug for me. I just love it.
Yes.
You know? And I think that that's necessary. That. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So with your own teaching, now we skipped, we haven't talked about your performance career, but you did perform all around the world.
Yes, and I wouldn't maximize that. I tell people I had a small regional career. Although okay. I did perform in Europe, and I did perform in, you know, I did something small in the Netherlands. And, most of my work has been here in Canada and in the States.
Okay. Yeah. So you've had the performance, so let's say regional performance career.
Yeah.
You have your university training, and you do a lot of reading. I know we're going to talk about your research work as well. But what has been your greatest inspiration, or who's been your greatest mentor when it's come to you, first up with your own career and then as a teacher or as a singer?
Career-wise and as a teacher, as a singer, well, I will say, so before I returned to grad school, I spent 5 years learning from Canadian bass baritone Gary Relier. And his son, John Relier, is also an operatic bass baritone who's doing very well for himself. Gary helped me discover my adult voice. Up until I worked with him, my very first singing teacher told me you should always try to sound as young as possible.
Oh.
And I understand now, you know, now that I'm not young anymore, I understand where that was coming from.
21,
right? Times two and a, yeah. So I understand where that advice was coming from, but it's not good advice. And it's not good advice for a low male voice singer who is used by classical singing as an archetype of the patriarchy. We're always gods and fathers and kings and demons and prophets and male authority figures.
Yes.
So to sound, to try and make a young tone instead of, like I haven't sung today, sorry.
That's all right. I haven't spoken today till
right,
now.
You haven't. Cross time zones. But there was an aesthetic barrier for me between discovering what my voice was really capable of as an adult and the idea that I needed to sound as young as possible. Right.
Yes.
So Gary was able to help me discover how to get my folds to meet in that full fold way that's necessary for basses. And he did it basically with a year's worth of me making barnyard noises. I was bent over at the waist and mooing like a cow for a long time. And
and roaring like a bull.
Well, I was just going, and believe me, I wondered like, what the hell am I paying for? What is this? You know,
but you know, I'm laughing not at you, but with you, because I do that with my students. Like making animal noises at times, like puppy whimpers and meowing like a cat.
Yes.
And, you know, so many of those things really do help.
They really, really do help. And our body wants to do them. Our body knows how to play.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's amazing when you take singing away from somebody and just get them to create sound.
That's so
all of a
hard,
sudden,
though.
Everything opens up, doesn't it?
But how hard is it to get, you know, you've got a smart, motivated, hungry young student in your studio, and how hard is it to pry their commitment to beauty of tone away from them enough for them to play and discover who they really are?
Yeah.
You know, it's emotional. Yeah.
It is emotional, but I think that comes down to trust. When you have built that relationship with the student and they trust you and you've created that safe space for them, I think that is the best way to get them to do those kinds of things.
Yes, it is.
And then when they work, when they discover that after the first time of doing something like that and it actually works, they go, we don't know what just happened, but this feels really good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's a humbling moment, isn't it? There's just space to just stop and experience humility when a student does trust you to get in there and fiddle with the machinery. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And isn't it great to have those moments? I don't know about you, but when a student does something really well, you've worked with them, they've they've trusted you and they've gone on that journey with you and they achieve that one thing that they've really wanted to achieve, I still feel it in my body, that sense of pride and gratitude. Do you get like that?
Yeah. I mean, how could you not, right? There's a brilliant Rilke quote that I can't, I'm sorry, I don't have it at my fingertips. I suppose I could Google it. But he basically says that it takes a constellation of errors for any one person to ever truly successfully advise another person. And that magnificent, serendipitous, accidental confluence of being able to have a bit of your knowledge and perception graft onto another human in their journey, that's a big deal.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And did you always want to be a teacher, a singing teacher, or did you just fall into it like most of us did?
I think I always wanted to teach, although my mom, back when she was alive, she saved this drawing I did when I was 4 or 5 of me preaching as a sort of a preacher in a pulpit. So some kind of public facing something. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't know if I ever felt entitled to teach because I was never sure how to sing when I was in my 20s and 30s. You know, when I went, so I went back to grad school in 2012, when I was 40 and I had figured out how I do what I do. So it was easy for me to, well, it was an odd experience too, because I was sitting in my master's classes next, you know, rubbing shoulders with 20-year-olds and thinking to myself, my God, they have a world-class instrument. Why aren't they using it? And I think it's because they hadn't lived enough. Mm-hmm. Like I remember asking, and this was one of the horrible mistakes I made in grad school, because there was a young lady who was in my, I guess it was a leader class, and she sang and she was all tied up in knots. And when she came back, you know, I asked her, like, where's your personal power? Like, where is your, you know, because she was obviously very, very bright. And the voice was just tied up in knots and not able to express clearly all the work and research that she'd done on her piece. And she just burst into tears. And I thought, well, man, you just stuck your foot in it. You know, it was a big, painful experience for me in needing to check my own privilege and understand that people are not always going to receive an honest question from where it's coming from.
Yes.
So I regretted that. And also she looked the stink eye at me for the next, you know, 3 years too, because I really damaged her with this question.
Wow.
Sure. But we're artists and we're, you know, vulnerable egos. And of course, how dare you?
Yes. So yes. Because
If I could do it over, I would never have now I understand that you don't, that's not your business.
But yes.
In the moment, you know, it was just so clear to me that this, like, you've got everything it takes. Where is your sense of, like, where's your personal power? And
yes. Well, you know what? It was probably, you probably were thinking that maybe it shouldn't have asked that, because you do think that at times. At times you do have someone in front of you who has an amazing gift, an amazing talent, but they don't have everything else that they need to have to make it. There's a lot of other attributes that you need. I laugh at myself in one sense, because I think I was never the best at anything. Like, really, I've had to work really hard to be good at anything. But you know, when you want it so badly, it's this poor girl, she may not have worked out that you have to want it and you have to go after it. You can't just expect it to arrive. So you have, and then you need to be able to market yourself, and you have to have a certain amount of ego or confidence as well. So I think I had all those things, but, and the talent kind of followed along, but I had a fantastic career and I did better than a lot of those people that you're talking about.
But that falls, like, your personal experience, I think, is well documented. I think people acknowledge that it, what is it, 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration?
Like, yes.
Yeah.
I used to teach the business side of the industry. And I used to say in the first lesson, it's 20% talent and 80% everything else. You don't need to be the most gifted to have the best career. And yeah. That was me, you know.
Well,
I mean, I probably wasn't that shabby, but just saying, I know that there were people out there that were way better than I was and they weren't working. I was always working. I was a hustler. So.
Well, you have to think too, just talking about people who may be perceived as less talented or less coordinated, let's say. Mm-hmm. That's a nicer way to frame it. Mm-hmm. If, as voice teachers, we can't help those students to coordinate better, then what are we doing? Right? They're coming to school to learn how to sing.
Yes,
I can help you coordinate your body in a way that's going to help you deliver this repertoire. If you can't do that, what are you doing taking people's money?
Like, yes, it is. And we're really in a privileged situation as voice teachers. We are privileged to be able to have those students in front of us, that they trust us with their instrument. And we can really do some damage. Like, we have to be so careful. And you often hear about students that have had a terrible experience with a voice teacher along the way, and a lot of teachers themselves who have had a bad experience when they were learning. Did that ever happen to you?
Oh my God, yes. Did it happen to you? Like,
yes, but not till later. Like, I did have some training. It was in CCM and it was in the 70s. I don't know how that happened or who this person.
That's exceptional. Yeah.
It was exceptional. So I'm thinking they may have come from the Seth Riggs, maybe from along that school of training. I don't know who else was out there at that time. Mm-hmm. But really, no, that person was an amazing teacher, very supportive teacher. Like, I had training in so many things that a lot of teachers don't offer now. I was taught how to perform to a TV camera, how to sing in a recording studio. I was taught how to sing a big cabaret show, how to sing in an intimate space. Like, I had such well-rounded training, and it was all from a very positive, inspiring, encouraging space.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe that's what gave me the audacity to get up there where some of the others didn't. So what about you then? What happened? What was your experience? What was something that happened that could have been to your detriment?
Something that happened that could have been to my detriment. Well, we were talking about teachers and positive, you know, positive, well, or less than positive experiences with teachers. I think, so in my life, I've had 10 voice teachers. And I, knowing what I know now, like, it's been strange, you know, Marissa, to cross an educational threshold. So now I have a doctorate in music.
Yes.
With a specialization in voice pedagogy. Mm-hmm. And so just objectively, I have to admit that I now have better training than a lot of my teachers on the way here had.
Yes. Yes.
So there's a split screen on that where I'll look back at a bad fit with a teacher, mm-hmm. and you have the emotions that you had or the processing that you had at the time, which would include confusion and why things aren't working. And you're, you know, you maybe owning that and thinking, oh, what's wrong with me that I can't get this and whatnot. But now on this side of my educational arc, I can take a look at those bad fits and say, oh, well, they had a different agenda. I can see that now. Or, oh, they didn't know how to teach this. Or this person didn't know how to work with a low male voice.
Yes. Or, yes.
Like, like all of these things have become, instead of committing me to the negative interpretation of a bad fit historically mm-hmm. in my development, my training now allows me to go, well, they didn't know what I know now. That's mm-hmm. all.
Yes. No. This is just something that came to mind because we refer to you as being a bass voice. Now, me being the CCM singer, and we don't have the FARC system, as you know. So what are your notes? What is the range for a bass?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm not sure who the audience for your podcast is and whether or not they would have a working understanding of the FARC system. So mm-hmm. I'll just say
probably,
really quickly.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, so
we I'll have just a say diverse really, audience.
All right, so I'll just explain in 15 seconds or less.
Yes.
That FACH, F-A-C-H, is a German word that means pigeonhole. And it is a tool that's used by German opera houses to divide people up into categories that they mm-hmm. can use as chess pieces to populate their seasons. So if you audition for a house in Germany and you're a specific kind of soprano, a certain FACH of soprano, they'll hire you and then you're expected to do all of the soprano roles that are assigned to that FACH in whatever shows they're doing that season. Mm-hmm. And you can't really be asked to sing a soprano role that's not in your lane.
Right.
So it protects the singer from being abused and it protects the house so they get the maximum bang for their buck. Mm-hmm. The FACH system has been misapplied outside of German opera houses.
Right. So that's interesting.
FACH has no meaning outside of that. Like in the, like on the oratorio stage or with symphonic repertoire, any number of voices can sing as a soloist, depending on what the conductor wants for the color of the soprano. You know, if he wants a heavier voice, he'll hire a heavier voice. If he wants a lighter voice, he'll hire a lighter voice. So FACH is not something to get hung up about. And also, and I'll put this cheeky plug in there, FACH is what you get hired for. Actually, FACH is what you get hired back for. So if you're a working singer, and people are hiring you. So my FACH is serioso bass, serious bass, right? Because all of the opera roles that I get hired to do, Spadafucile and Zarastro and whatever, those are serioso bass roles, right? But it doesn't matter in oratorio because bass is just bass in oratorio.
Right, okay.
If you like me, my personality and my color of voice, then you hire mm-hmm. me for your oratorio. Mm-hmm. In CCM, you don't have FACH per se, but you do have qualified calls. Like for instance, the closest that we get to a bass, I think in Rent would be the role of Collins. Mm-hmm. He'd be a baritone, really.
Yes.
But that's a lowish voice.
Yes. Know? Yes. And in Jesus Christ Superstar, Caiaphas, right. We had
Caiaphas,
a yes.
Exactly. Yes.
That was that's the only bass singer that I've heard before.
Sure. So you'll like is it Guzman? Somebody did their dissertation and they quoted me in it, which was weird to see. Fascinating, wonderful.
Yeah,
wonderful
that's amazing.
But he did his dissertation on low male voice roles in music theater. And there are more than a few. Saying that there are more of a few, still the tenor gets the top billing. It's always, you know, high notes are the money notes. Mm-hmm. And low male voices in music theater are still character. Although Emil in South Pacific, you know, it's a baritone, you know. Mm. And in pop music, there's not a lot of space for a low male voice outside of the novelty of our color, unless you're the bass in an a cappella group.
Yes, like the Four Seasons or like Frankie.
Oh, actually, I was thinking more like Pentatonix, right?
Oh,
like,
okay.
Like Abby, yes. Abby Kaplan, who was in mm-hmm. Pentatonix. I think he's left the group now.
Yeah.
But, and also, what's his name from Take Six? Oh, the best bass ever. Like, Yeah, but the aesthetic of an a cappella group depends on a bass to be the harmonic underpinning.
Yes.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Duncan Rock, who is a professional baritone, and he said that when he found out, when his voice settled and he was a baritone, he went to classical training. Before that, he was in a rock band, and he was told he was a baritone. He was really disappointed because he said that he thought it was like a ranking system and the baritone was at the bottom of the rank, like the tenor was up there. He didn't realize, he didn't understand the system and the voices, and he thought in the ranking system he had drawn the short straw. Yeah,
that's a funny misunderstanding and not one that I've heard before.
It's
my understanding that and maybe somebody else will correct me on this, but it's my understanding that classical music anyway, in opera, sort of inherits the way it treats voice types from Commedia dell'arte.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, sopranos, you know, virginal, heavenly, angels, basses, demons, gods, kings, right? Like there's an archetypal sort of usage to the way that those voices are used. And I'm happy to say that in new Canadian repertoire that's being written, that's not the case anymore. They're using these voices. They're breaking away from old stereotypes. And I think that that's important.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, you have been teaching online for some time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Solely online since we all went online in 2020.
Okay. Before that, you weren't online?
No. I was teaching from my studio at home downstairs. And it was going terrific. But we moved online and so did I. And I think I might stay online.
Yes.
I really like it.
Yes, you do. So, what are some of the surprising benefits that you found, or some of the things that you didn't think were possible by teaching online?
Reach. My studio reaches to Germany now. My studio, like, I'm able to teach students. I had somebody book me. Where were they? Were they in Austria?
Mm-hmm.
Which is just amazing to me, right?
And
you're in Australia right now.
Yes, yes.
I'm in Toronto, and we're having a conversation with no delays.
I know.
That's astonishing.
And isn't it lovely? Like, I speak to my colleagues overseas all the time, and it just feels like you're in the same room with them.
Yeah, it really does.
Yes.
So there's a couple of bits of software that you can use to sort of even tighten it up even more. And so I have some of that stuff here. But for the most part, my lessons, you don't even process that there's a delay. And I'm finding that our students are really technologically savvy, and they're willing, you know, whatever it takes to connect, they'll accommodate.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So have you found the teaching to be as effective online?
Well, I was taught not to touch my students physically.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that for liability reasons, but also, you know, comfort reasons. And, you know, you think of it, I'm a big cisgendered man in a room with a younger student. Like, it just makes sense not to physically touch. And even though touch has helped me in the past as a student of singing, I respond to my training not to touch by not touching.
Yes.
So I would say that because touch is not in the equation, the way I teach, that most of what I would be able to help the student with by way of interventions is achievable online. And we've had a couple of, you know, funny things where I'll reposition the camera to show, you know, no, I want you to, you know, that, like, bending over at the waist, or redistributing your body gravity, or, you know, modeling a head out of alignment or a head in alignment. All of these things I think are achievable with an online paradigm. I do miss, though, like, you know, I had a my first low male voice student that I was preparing for university, we'd sit down when he'd come, we'd sit down and have a cup of tea at the beginning and just sort of talk to him about, about, you know, what was going on at school and how we were going to look at things. And so I miss that kind of time. I suppose you could still have tea with somebody online.
Well, you can.
That hasn't been part of my online expression.
Well, you have a coffee, and a coffee has miraculously turned up in my household too, and nice. My water. Yes, and that's really interesting, you checking in with that student, because that is something that we all kind of do, whether we do it instinctively or not, even if it's to go or to ask them, okay, how has your week been? You know, we kind of do that little check-in, because as singing teachers, I feel that we talk about that safe space with our students, and often they share things with us that they wouldn't normally share with other people. And, okay, we are not psychologists, nor do we pretend to be, but at times students do open up to us. They're finding their voice, they're discovering themselves. Has that changed in that online platform?
Well, you're asking a good question. So that did happen, like with my student that I was talking about, part of receiving him and the first question being, would you like a cup of tea? Part of that was defusing him from his day, because he made me aware earlier that he dealt with some anxiety, which we all do, right?
Yes. And so, yes, just about everybody right now, whether they want to admit it or not.
So the process for him was cup of tea and then stretching, basically doing like alignment and stretching and whatnot, was basically the first 15 minutes of our time together. And that the function of that was to just get him into his body and out of his day a little bit.
You know? Yes, yes.
I teach the students that I have right now that form my virtual studio are not developmentally as formative as that wonderful student. So he was in a certain place in his developmental arc, and the students that I have now are not in that particular place. And so a few of my students, I feel like they're coming to me for my specific knowledge. And if there are personal questions or if there's informal banter, it's usually in the context of some funny passing thing, because we're humans, you know?
Yes.
But it's less, I feel like the quality of my lessons now have less of a personal mentorship feel and more of a professional and technical and musical mentorship feel. And that's okay, because if we think of these as the warp and weft of our studio over time, this is just the expression of my studio at the moment. And maybe this time next year, I'll have half a dozen undergraduates who, you know, need to sort their heads out. And so that'll be what we process while we work on Art Song. Who knows?
Yes, absolutely. And your teaching philosophy that I found when I was delving into you and your website, I thought that was beautiful. We learn by doing, and I believe that singing well is largely about self-discovery and self-acknowledgement. Ultimately, we own our vocal discoveries most deeply when we teach ourselves to sing, how to sing. Where did that come from? Is that just your experience as a teacher, as someone who has trained themselves, as someone who has had a performance career, as someone who has done the research? Is it all of that has arrived at that point for you?
Yeah, again, you're looking at what I consider as a snapshot in time. So I love that that meant something to you, and it's very gratifying. But I also don't expect that's the finished word for me on singing.
Yes.
I don't know if you noticed, but this week I posted something in the forum that was something about, it was like an open letter to my singer saying, like, "Dear singer, the reason I ask you so many questions is because the stuff that you discover about yourself is going to stick better than if I just tell you the answer."
Yes.
Did you see that post?
Yes. I didn't. I didn't see that post. So I'm going to go back and look at it. I'd like to see the comments.
Yeah. Well. And there's some good comments on there.
Yes.
But I think that falls in line with what you just read. I really believe, and look, our students are paying us for our guidance. They're paying us to show them where the guide ropes are and to hear some interventions that'll help them optimize what they already do well and minimize what they don't do so well and strengthen this and hone that. But I ultimately believe that we do teach ourselves to sing. And so when I propose an intervention, it isn't with the thought, so do it right from now on. It's, have I given them enough lead in for them to trip over their own solution? You know?
Yes.
Like, have I peppered the path with enough breadcrumbs so that they fall onto, oh, this is how you know? Because it's more like trying to explain somebody how to ride a bike than anything, right? Like, how do you frame the balance in your inner ear? Right?
You
do it by falling down. You learn to sing by singing, and you learn to sing by singing badly sometimes, and that's okay.
Yes.
Or you learn to sing by singing well and excelling, and then all of a sudden it not going so well, and you having to stop and take a look at how to do on purpose what came naturally at a certain point. Mm-hmm. That's an important moment too.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've done a lot of research. I mean, you have a lot of research interests, and they're really quite broad. I mean, applied vocal acoustics, motor learning theory. There's so many voice pedagogy, voice habilitation. Which one of those is most fascinating to you? Do you have a favorite?
Oh, so I will respectfully reframe what you just asked, because
you can disrespectfully, it's okay.
No, never. Research is a funny word to use for what I am. I think of myself more as a consumer of other people's research.
I would agree based on what I've seen in the forum.
So a consumer and a curator of other people's research. So for motor learning theory, I mean, nothing, I have no primary research to offer that, but I do know to point to Lynn Helding's book and to Christine Bergen's Journal of Singing article on motor learning theory that gives you the basic vocabulary of it. And a number of other, like, I can build you a bibliography of places to look for that.
Yes. But
I wouldn't say that motor learning is a passion of mine. I just think it's damn useful. My twin areas of expertise are low male voice development and Russian lyric diction. Mm-hmm. So those are my twin passions. Low male voice development, because I always wanted to understand myself, and I was never certain that my teachers had specific knowledge of specific low male voice challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'll say about that. Russian lyric diction, because I had to work so hard to acquire that knowledge. And I waded through all of the English print literature on Russian lyric diction to arrive at a basic understanding of how to pronounce Russian for the stage. So those are my twin passions. The other stuff, is stuff that I think is important, stuff that I would like to know more about, stuff that I am excited to consume when I see new bits about it, and stuff that I'm happy to compile good, responsible bibliographies on that can help other people who really are interested in those things.
Yes. You know?
I don't really know much about trans voice instruction or the politics around that, but I know who to ask.
Yes. And I have a podcast on that too.
Good. Great.
Yes, there's Perfect. An episode on that one. I can't tell you the number, but I know I do.
And the world needs that knowledge, and I'm so glad that
yes,
you...
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it was very, very interesting. I learned so much in that episode.
Isn't that great? Like when I learn something, like I just, I love that. I love that.
Is that love of learning what led you to all the books? Dan, you have a new book. At least every week a new book arrives at your doorstep, I'm sure.
I wonder if people think that I read them all.
You don't? Do you just like having them?
I have, well, okay. So some books you sit and read, like Lynn Helding's book you would want to read. Karen Brunson has a book on the life cycle of the voice that I think makes for good reading through. I reviewed Carrie Reagan's book, and that made for really good reading through. Mm-hmm. But other books are reference books. And, you know, I don't know if I could sit and read the book by Tietze, Principles of Voice Production. That to me, you dip into for important nuggets, right?
Right.
Maybe somebody out there has read it through, but I'll tell you, I read Richard
Probably
Miller's.
Probably Ian Howe.
I'm sure Ian Howe. Well, but then again, Ian reads the way he reads too, right?
Like, okay, yes. and I can say that because I know Ian, and I said that with love.
Yeah. Oh, with nothing but love for Ian.
Yes.
I can tell you that as someone who moderates a forum, my first thought when dealing with a challenge is always, how would Ian act? Like,
that speaks volumes.
Yeah. But I learned how to be a little bit less of myself and a little bit more of Ian when it's advantageous that way. He's just so thoughtful and reasonable and kind.
Yes.
And the world needs more of that.
Oh, yeah. That's really nice. We'll have to send him that snippet that you actually said all that
about. He doesn't need another love note from me. He knows how
I feel. Oh, okay. So I know some of the books that you have are really old literature. Like some of them are so, so old.
Oh.
I have seen some of the books, you know, the hardback books. Some of them, you know, go back, I think Garcia, some of those.
Sure. Did I send you my library link? So I keep a link to my library.
Yes, I have that. I have that. So when you go back and you read some of the older literature, let's just call it the older literature.
So we'll call that historical voice pedagogy literature. Historical voice.
Yeah, I love that. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So when you read the historical voice pedagogy literature, and do you think to yourself, these people were onto something here? Or, like, do you think, what were they thinking? Or do you think, wow, we should have stopped and listened and taken note of some of this?
Oh, Marissa, you ask all the good questions. So,
good.
One of the best parts about owning my own books is that I get to write in the margins.
Ah.
And if I've read a book, my books are full of underlines and exclamation marks and notes like, you know, look at such and such, or what would Miller say about this, or na na na. And exactly what you're asking is in the margins of many of my books.
You know? I want your margins.
Every once in a while, I'll post a photograph, a snapshot of a page of something, and you can see my margins.
I've seen your margins, yes.
Right. Right. I use a red pen to write margin notes on journal articles.
Right.
The ones that I print out. But in my books, it's always pencil because I think, okay, when I'm dead and gone, somebody's going to want to erase it. Yeah,
exactly. Right. And it's respect to the author.
So I had this conversation with somebody earlier this week about a respectful understanding of the context of where the author was writing from. Mm-hmm. So we know a lot better now than they mm-hmm. did back in the day. Mm-hmm. And it is like time has fast forwarded at us X amount of decades. Mm-hmm. And we've been given the crib notes to all the answers that you see them teasing out. So when you read Lily Lehmann's book,
yes,
and you see all those crazy drawings of her notes above the head, which are beautiful art, you know, we understand now, thanks to Chadley Ballantyne popularizing them, that a lot of that has to do with Pacinian corpuscles and the vibrations where we experience them in our skin. And that is something that would have blown Lily Lehmann's mind, because she was dead sure that a C natural was right here. Right?
Right. Okay.
So when I read that stuff, a lot of the time I think quaint, but not in a patronizing way, mm-hmm. in a way of, wow, this is how a turn of the century woman who'd had a career, she was teaching placement because that's what worked for her and that's what had paid for her house. Mm-hmm. So in as much as I know that placement isn't real, I accept that it can be a very helpful way to fall into that self-understanding that I talked about earlier.
Yes, absolutely. Right? Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, we all want to be evidence-based, but at the same time, whatever gets you there is a right answer.
Mm-hmm. So with all the knowledge that we have now, all the science, do you think we're creating better singers as a result of that?
Well, I am going to risk answering your question with a straight up yes. I do think
okay.
so.
Okay.
Now, I have some books in my library. If you look up Talia's books, they're literally called We Sang Better. Right? So he disagrees with me. I think he's an Australian too.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah. Okay. So possibly. Take a look through my library.
Yes.
So there is a large vocal contingent out there that thinks, you know, that singing is in a constant state of decline and they're, you know, deplorable today versus blah, blah, blah. My sense is I bet singers are a lot better now because the science is better and the reach, like the classism mm-hmm. for singing is less of a thing. Like you don't need to live with a master singer for 5 years before you're allowed on stage now.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
You can come from a have not family and wind up becoming an expert in singing.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. That's a great way of looking at it.
Yeah. So anyway, I do think that it's so hard to tell without recorded evidence, but I bet that more people are helped to sing better now than back in the day.
Mm. Do you think that science and the knowledge that is giving us is just helping us get to the problem a little quicker?
Yeah.
And figuring it out, like it's helping us to diagnose and to fix. Whereas before, maybe that it just took them that little bit longer because they didn't have that understanding.
Well, we can't ignore. So science has no agency, right? Science is just an inanimate tool, a thought. It's a way of processing information. And science doesn't mean anything until you put it in the hands of a practitioner. And whether that practitioner's purpose is to respect the science or to try and sell some other point, that's the knot that I see I don't think scientific discovery helps until singing teachers can apply it with predictable results. So I don't think it's not quite right. And I'm sorry, my thoughts aren't gelling very well about this. I don't think that new scientific discoveries about the voice are a panacea for our vocal problems. I think that there's a role for teachers like you and me to curate this information and filter it so that we can meet our students where they're at.
Yes.
And not data yes. dump on them and yes. not show them that we know things, you know, like.
Oh, you're speaking my language right now because, well, no, I totally understand. And personally, I totally agree with you. I think sometimes my fear is when, not necessarily your forum, but sometimes in other forums, there's a lot of look what I know rather than.
Well, that, you know, who's to say that somebody doesn't receive my latest book recommendation as some kind of flex from me? Look what I know. Mm. Right. Like,
yeah, but it's the spirit in which you write the context around what you're telling us.
But well, you're kind in receiving it the way I intend it. But I also accept that other folks may be sitting back with their arms crossed and going, who does he think he is?
Mm. But what you touched upon was the fact that it still comes back to the student. We must be student-centric.
We must be student-centric.
And that to me means that the voice isn't just a larynx. We're dealing with a human being.
A human being.
And
have you, I want to come back to Carrie Reagan's model for evidence-based practice in the voice studio. Mm-hmm. And one of her pillars is actually a student input. Like it's hardwired into her model of how things ought to work in the studio. There is a branch for evidence-based practice for sure, but that's not the end of the story. It also, there's a dialogue that needs to happen. And, you know, how was that is often the most important question we can ask a student after an
evidence. Yes, yes, yes. And also, was there something that you weren't happy about there, you know, or you, like I'm very big on having that student tell me what they're thinking, you know, and what they're wanting, because I work with a lot of singer-songwriters and so they have a preconceived idea of what they want.
Sure they do.
And for me it's about facilitating that and helping them expand on that as well. But at the end of the day, yeah, I mean, I want to introduce other colours as well, so it broaden their horizons and not just give them what they want, allow them to play in that safe environment to introduce new sounds, and then they can decide if they want to use them or not in maybe their next song, and not limit them. But to create sustainability is what I feel my job is in the sounds that they want to make. So it is very student-centric and relying on that feedback. And that's what I loved about what you said. When it comes to science, we can't forget about that. We have to look at the human, and it's not just a larynx. There's a whole person in front of us.
Sure there is. And I'm also reminded from motor learning theory about in terms of a feedback sense, you know, we want to be of service to the student, but also stopping after each effort and going, how was that? Or what do you think? Or that's not optimal either.
We need to
talk less and create time for them to phonate. Mm-hmm. My sense is that if I'm phonating more, if I'm speaking more in a voice lesson than the student is, then I fail.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It's picking and choosing your moments to phonate, isn't
and
it?
And also letting them, which is so hard for me because I'm such a clucking mother hen, but letting them struggle sometimes. Like the good things come from a student that resolves their own struggle.
Yes, I have a student came to mind immediately when you made that statement. And I thought, that's a student right now that I'm having to allow that to happen. It is hard. But sometimes when you've tried everything else, you've got to let them go and do it their way and see how it works for them as well, without any damage, of course. So based on everything, the science, the books, the literature, everything, what do you feel that we can do better as a voice community? I mean, I know that's a big question and I've just thrown that at you. But is there in any area that you feel that, gee, you know, we can do a little bit better in this field or in this particular topic? Or
you and I are surrounded by luminaries, by gifted experts, by generous colleagues.
Yes.
And so I would not dare to put on them what I'm going to suggest. So I'll speak about myself and what I could do better. Great.
Okay. Yes.
I could listen better. And I know that sounds pretty fundamental because we all know, you know, you want to compliment a teacher, you tell them they have big ears, right? We value the ear of the teacher, but I don't always listen for content. And I am embarrassed to say, and you'll see this in the forums sometimes too, like I could read more attentively. I could suss out nuance. I could listen from the perspective that somebody is not raising a contrasting point to be argumentative, but that they're trying to achieve deeper understanding. I could take that for granted. Mm-hmm. And I don't always have the bandwidth to live from that place. So for myself, I would like to listen better. And I think that I would like to listen better in conversations between colleagues like we're having now, but also I'd like to listen better for insights when I read those bits of historical voice pedagogy and go, you know, Tetrazzini really knew her stuff back in the day. She did the best with what she had.
Yes. You know? Exactly, the best with what she had.
Listening and reading between the lines and not just crossing my arms and go, well, that's ridiculous. Why would you create a whole vowel system? And go, wow, man, Coffin, you were ahead of your time. You were like what you would have done with a MacBook and Pratt.
Yes.
You know.
Now, we're going to come to the end of our interview. You've been so kind. I could talk to you for hours and days, and we probably would do that. But I want to end with a little bit of fun here. Now, when we read magazines, there's always a lot of stuff. There's a lot of rubbish out there that we read about some of our favorite stars and people that we know that are in the media. And these are some little things that I've read about you. So I've papped you without the photo. Like I'm the paparazzi behind the bushes that's gone. This is what he was doing at this point of time. So I would like for you, make a statement and then you give me a true or false. How's that?
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay. All right. You have two dogs and they are Bernese Mountain Dogs.
That is correct.
And they are your babies.
Oh yeah, for sure. We're spending all of our kid names on dogs. That is accurate.
So what are they called?
My boys, my older dog is Owen and my younger dog is Connor.
And how old are they?
Owen will be 10 in December and Connor will be 8 in November.
Oh, they're coming up to puberty. The older you one know, is.
They're actually at the end of their life cycle. Burners don't live for very long. So.
You are wonderful. Okay. And you are married.
I am married.
Mm-hmm. You have suffered chronic back pain.
Oh, yes. I saw a physiatrist today about it.
A physiatrist.
Physiatrist, yeah.
I've not heard of that one. That's
it's a doctor of physical therapy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Don't we call them physiotherapists?
I think you can be a physiotherapist without a doctorate. This guy has a PhD in what he does.
Oh, okay. Well, he is entitled to be a physiatrist then.
Right. it was new. Like,
he can call himself whatever he wants in my
house. If he helps my back feel better, you're right.
So, absolutely. Yeah, I had
debilitating back pain for about 14 months, and I'm at the end of it now. And
oh, good.
But his advice was strength training. He said, don't be afraid. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and try and be active.
Is that core strength training?
I used to do Olympic lifts. So like squats and clean and jerks and that kind of stuff. And so.
Wow.
Yeah. And he said, don't go from having experienced chronic back pain for a year to straight into it. But he said, do bodyweight squats, you know, check your alignment. You know what to do. You know what to do to. And this is one of the mixed blessings of being a singer, because we know our transverse abdominis and our obliques and our erector spinae and all that stuff, right?
Yes.
So I'm aware of how to strengthen that stuff. And he's like, yeah, go ahead and do the hard work now. Get your body
that's
back.
So you got the thumbs up from the physiatrist.
Yeah. Yeah. Check in with me in another 2 months and we'll see where we're
at. You're on. You don't like anti-vaxxers ranting on Facebook.
Oh,
I did say ranting.
I have space for people with legitimate questions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that over 6 billion doses of the vaccine have been administered. And it's time to stop pretending that people without a legitimate reason to not have the vaccine are anything but selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And if we behaved with that understanding, policy would change.
Absolutely. Okay. You love TikTok.
Do I love TikTok? I think I'm a little addicted at the moment, but
addicted. Mm-hmm. You're addicted to TikTok. Sure.
I don't know. I mean, it's...
How did
serotonin,
you start?
Dopamine. I just was curious. I'm curious about social media and wherever I see something of value, I'm ready to bring it in and share it. Mm-hmm. You must be talking about some of the TikToks that I've linked to in the forum. So they'll have to do with physiology.
And on your personal page.
Yeah. So they'll have to do with things that I'm interested in, right? Or cute animals.
Oh, you can't go past those ones.
Yeah, love them.
And you've played soccer.
I played soccer in a co-ed recreational soccer league for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I miss it terribly. I would love to play. I can't play with the back pain that I'd had, but I'm hopeful that I'll be able to resume next year.
Yes. Okay. And what are you working on right now? Do you have a specific project that you're working on?
That was
the end of the true and false, by the way. And I did really good.
Yes.
I did good. I should be writing the magazine articles.
I tell true stories
and not all the lies.
Right. Well, I expected a big lie in there for me to be able to say was false, but it didn't quite happen.
No.
Okay. So right now I'm working on a couple of articles. Yes. And they're occupying my time and attention. I think there's space for somebody to, you know what? That's all I'll say.
Okay. No, surprise us. And when it's closer to the time, we'll do another interview and you can tell me all about them. We can promote them.
Oh, fun.
How's that? Okay.
Yeah, I love it.
Okay. What is the greatest piece of advice you would like to give our singing voice community? If you could just say whatever you wanted.
Be kind.
I knew you were going to say that. How weird.
You know what? It's career limiting to not be kind So whether you think about the carrot or the stick, there's never a disadvantage to being kind.
Mm-hmm.
Even when you don't feel like it, be kind. And I'm speaking to myself as well.
Yes, yes.
But it matters to have a colleague, to be that colleague who's kind. Mm-hmm. And kind does not mean powerless.
Yes.
Kind does not mean ineffectual.
Yes.
Kind just means that you're kind.
Yes, I totally agree. And I think we have to start with ourselves. We have to be kinder to ourselves, and then we can be kinder to others.
But so I love the way you're framing that. And part of being kind to ourselves is being kind about our failure to be kind.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually
have to set that as an intention every day, is to be kind to myself so I can be kind to others.
Well, it's working because your way of being is undauntingly positive.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. What is, final question, what is the legacy that you would love to leave for the world? Your legacy, what would that be?
Honestly, I've thought about this a lot. I went through a bit of an existential crisis in my 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And the best thing that I can think of in response to that are what drives me, which are to love my family and to make good art. That's what I have to leave. If I invest myself and my goodness and my intention in the strong family that I have, so that we create an atmosphere of love and support here, that's something. And if I get to create good art, whether it's through a recording mm-hmm. I did mm-hmm. or whether it's through the legacy of students that I get to participate in now.
Yes. Yes.
But that's love my family and to make good art. I think that's why I'm on this planet.
Yes. Beautiful. Dan, it has been such a pleasure. Honestly, I could just speak to you forever and ever and ever.
Well, you're a terrific conversation partner, and I really, really love it.
Thank you. No, it's been such a joy, and we're going to pick this up again some other time. When you release your work, those two project pieces.
Right. Well, I'm sure we're going to cross paths at
Absolutely.
Some conference somewhere.
Absolutely. You know? And I promise to engage in the forum more.
Yeah, I mean,
I'll start dipping my toes.
I love that, because it's only as good as the people who participate.
Yes.
You know, we've been so lucky to have people give of their time and knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And every time somebody shares or opens up another stream of conversation, all it does is enrich everybody else's experience. So
yes, absolutely.
Participate. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you, Dan. I'm not going to keep you any longer, but I appreciate you so much, and keep up all the amazing work that you're doing. And we will connect sometime again in the future.
I look forward to it.
Take it easy. Bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of A Voice and Beyond. Now is an important time for all of us to spread positivity and empowerment in our singing voice community. It's time for you to invest in your own self-care, personal growth, and education. Use every day as an opportunity to learn and to grow, so you can show up for your students feeling energized, empowered, and ready to deliver your best. Be the best role model and mentor you can possibly be, and watch your students thrive as you do. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please make sure to share it with a friend or a colleague who you think will be inspired by this. Copy and paste the link and share it with the people you think will enjoy listening to this show. Please share it on social media and use the hashtag #AVoiceAndBeyond. If you would like to help me, please rate and review this podcast and cheer me on by clicking the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts right now. I would love to know what it is you enjoyed the most about this episode and what was the biggest takeaway for you. I promise you there are many episodes to follow as I'm committed to bringing you more inspiration and conversations just like this one. I'd like to finish up with my final thoughts. Remember that to sing is more than just learning how to use a voice. As singers, our whole body is the instrument, and our bodies echo what we feel physically, mentally, and emotionally. So singing is not just about the voice. It's about a voice and beyond. Please take care of yourself, and I look forward to your company next time.